This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A criminal justice sciences expert says the guilty verdict in the Derek Chauvin murder trial is a hopeful signpost that may make the next case easier, but he says it's far from a turning point in the national dialogue on race and police. Michael Gizzi joins us. When someone not from Apple replaces a battery in a phone, the software often gives the owner a warning about non-brand parts.
It puts doubt and fear in front of a customer that shouldn't be there.
Electronic service store owner Terry Ballantini tells you about a right to repair. Plus, an African-American man is Bloomington Normal's longest-serving plumber, and he's still going. Curtis Henry Sr. tells you what it's like to deal with pipes and poop for 57 years. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for Sound Ideas comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, the best hearing device center in the Pantograph Reader's Choice Awards for the sixth year in a row. Bloomington Normal Audiology thanks the listeners and their continued vote of confidence as the leaders in hearing and technology. With a practice featuring five doctors, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient and helps you keep hearing the most important sounds of your life. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. Illinois Wesleyan University plans to hold an in-person outdoor graduation this spring that will include a separate ceremony for the class of 2020 that never had a ceremony because of the pandemic. Dean of Students Carla Carney Hall says the May 2nd graduation will be held at a bigger space, Tucci Stadium, with masks and social distancing. Graduation is usually held in the campus quad.
I think it will still feel different, but I think it will feel really good to have everybody together celebrating our seniors and their success.
Carney Hall says IWU plans to have mostly in-person classes in the fall and go back to double occupancy dorms. Carney Hall says the university doesn't plan to require students to get vaccinated, but she says that could change if the federal government moves them beyond emergency use authorization. The McLean County Health Department reports 52 new COVID-19 cases and an additional hospitalization. There are now 54 county residents in the hospital with coronavirus complications. Hospital bed capacity tightened overnight. Intensive care bed use is up to 96%, an increase of 15%. Overall bed capacity is down to 8%. The county's active COVID caseload is down for the second day in a row. Just under 600 people are isolating at home. The new cases were found in a batch of about 1,300 test results returned overnight. The county's testing positivity rate rose slightly to 5.4%. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's educational video series, Hear My Story, continues with local patient Gina Barnhart.
I didn't remember that when you pulled a straw out of a wrapper, it made noise. So those kind of things were just like a shock to me that they make a sound and I didn't know it.
Gina's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. News of the guilty verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial is rocketing around the nation. Joining us to talk about the significance of that guilty verdict is Michael Gizzi, a criminal justice sciences professor at Illinois State University.
When I saw that there was a verdict so quickly, and I hadn't seen any news that the jury had kind of gone back to the judge or anything, you know, asking questions or anything, that would lead me to believe that it was going to be a guilty verdict. There was no way it was going to be a hung jury at this time. That was too soon, and there would have been back and forth between the jury and the judge, and I suspect the judge would have made them spend a lot more time. So I mean, it could have been the exact opposite, I guess, in theory, you know, but I think that was pretty doubtful given the evidence in the case. It was a pretty strong case.
Well, given that it was a strong case, and given the statutory difficulty of convicting police officers of misconduct if they are going about their work, they have some shelter in most states because of the workplace.
Qualified immunity.
Yeah. But is this a useful case to further a national dialogue above and beyond the symbolic importance that it has?
If this conviction couldn't happen, I don't know that any could. And so it's a tough question. I mean, I don't. I think the national dialogue is absolutely critical. Had it gone in the other direction, it would have been very clearly in my mind. It would have been, you know, saying there was something about this jury that wasn't willing to, you know, convict the cop. But I think it helped, because I think in some ways it might help cool down the tempers a little bit. It might alleviate some of the tension, but there is so much more work to do when it comes to police reform. So much more work to do. And I was reading a piece last week, I think it was from the New York Times, and it was a review of the states that have, you know, enacted police reforms in the last year, since the murder of George Floyd. And it's been pretty substantial, but a lot of those are, we have a lot further to go in holding police accountable. You know, they're the only entity in government that is largely allowed to regulate themselves.
And where should the regulation come from? Who watches the guardians?
Who watches the watchers? The people need to take control and take control through their legislatures. The challenge is, of course, no one wants to be painted as being, you know, weak on crime. And so historically, that's been very hard to do. And law enforcement has strong unions, and, you know, prosecutors are in the same camp. And so I would say in the last half a century, legislatures have not been willing, they haven't had the political will to do what they need to do, and which is to say, look, you know, law enforcement has a very important job, but they can't be so free from political accountability that they regulate themselves. And to be honest, the courts have not helped.
You and others in past interviews have made the point that the courts have largely allowed the rules to stand for use of force, and have enabled police to use pretextual stops and other enforcement techniques that can lead to more violence in unfortunate circumstances. So, and that's not going to go away.
Yeah, no, and that's where, you know, even though the courts say that, you know, police have this freedom, this discretion, you know, when legislatures pass laws, courts tend to, you know, I still think we can't count on the Supreme Court to change anything. That's pretty clear. But I was last week when the ex-cop was testifying about use of force, I felt like he was channeling his inner Bill Rehnquist, you know, former Chief Justice Rehnquist. It was like he might have been spouting from Graham versus Connor, the extremely deferential case that the Supreme Court handed down on use of force. And so when I think about it, I know none of this is easy, but if the people won't act through their legislatures, then we'll never get anywhere. The real challenge is how do we accomplish the goals that we need? How do we get reform without, we can't eliminate policing. Policing is important. Police officers are important. They do good work. But we can't just simply allow it to be painted as, oh, it's just a few bad apples. When there's a bad apple, that causes the whole thing to rot.
So how can police be brought by themselves, because legislation is going to take a number of years, perhaps a number of decades, to filter through with court tests as well. So how can the police be brought themselves to change the way they think about use of force?
Yeah, and that's a tough question. I really think it really demands leadership from the top in policing. You know, if we're serious about this, well, then police leadership, police chiefs need to say, we're not going to train officers the way we have been training them. And we need to change that. But we need to realize that the culture runs deep, and that to change the way policing works will never be a quick thing. You know, we don't have the freedom, the ability to simply say, all right, we're going to just basically start over, you know, with policing. And in many ways, I wish we could.
Well, you don't want them to start all the way over. I mean, as you said, they do good work.
Yeah, and most police officers are doing very good work, and they're not bad cops. But the police culture is something that getting change, we can't expect the officer in the ranks to be responsible for changing the entire culture. That's almost impossible. It has to be, they can push for it perhaps, but I think it really has to be from the top down in terms of police leadership. But yet, you know, I've seen situations where, you know, even forgetting use of force, and I just think about racial profiling, and I've had my own little battles with police chiefs about stuff like this, where they simply refuse to acknowledge that what they're doing, you know, creates a, you know, it deteriorates the police community relationship. I think back to the conference that GLT did about 5 years ago, and on race and policing, and you know, we have a long way to go.
So how would you frame the importance of this case in America? Is it a huge turning point? Is it a signpost along the way? What's your sense of it?
I think it's a signpost. I'm not convinced that it will lead to a wholesale change. But I think every time you have an example like this where the officer who was clearly guilty of a crime in doing his job is held accountable, that signpost can make it easier for the next case. You know, when you look at this case, basically the prosecutors weren't, that the individuals who prosecuted this case, they were not the normal, you know, in Illinois we would call the state's attorneys or the district attorneys. You know, these were brought in and to deal with it, because the prosecutorial police relationship is so tightly wound, it's very hard. But that could be one of the models that's very important, is you leave it to the state attorney general to, you know, to basically use special counsel, you know, to try cases like this. We can't leave these cases in the hands of the normal process. It's a positive guidepost.
Illinois State University Criminal Justice Sciences Professor Michael Gizzi, thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. Consumer advocates say the pandemic has shown we need right to repair laws. Sabrina Clevenger with the Illinois Public Interest Research Group says a majority of consumer electronics manufacturers don't provide parts information for consumers or repair shops. She says those gadgets often get thrown out too soon. Terry Ballantini runs an electronics repair store in Bloomington. He tells Eric Stock the pandemic helped his business. Ballantini also says manufacturers make repair work difficult and expensive for the consumer.
Our business really grew a bit last year because of the pandemic. Unfortunately, people were home, staying home. Kids were doing online, you know, Zoom classes. Parents were working at home. People were just breaking left and right. And so the majority of the things that we saw an increase were tablets, gaming computers, and cell phones, screens and batteries, you know, they would just drain out. So it's amazing that just this influx of broken items because of the pandemic.
And so how did this become a problem for you?
It has been difficult, you know, more difficult over the last year as Apple and Samsung and other manufacturers grow in their product line, they are making it more difficult for the small repair shop on the corner like us. They're making it difficult. We used to replace batteries tenfold every day on smartphones, and we still do. But now if you replace an iPhone battery, you'll get a message that says, oh, this may not be a genuine Apple battery. You might want to be careful for that. And that questions our ability of doing a good repair or people like us. And so when you have circumstances like that, it puts doubt and fear in front of a customer that shouldn't be there, because we have the absolute right of fixing our devices and should have that right. And that's what this whole right to repair law is about.
So what is the risk then to the consumer who takes it into your place of business as opposed to taking it back to the manufacturer?
Well, the first thing is inconvenience. You know, I mean, we alone today, we've had customers that come in that are getting pop-ups on their iPad or their phones that they can't get solid answers through Apple, or driving 2.5 hours from, you know, from Bloomington Normal all the way up to Chicago or St. Louis to visit an Apple store. So it's that frustration from those customers that, you know, they rely on us to help them.
And Terry, have you had to turn customers away at any point because they felt that they couldn't have you work on it for fear of perhaps losing their insurance, if you will?
Overall, no, not really. We do lose customers that come in that want us to be an Apple, you know, certified store, and we are not an Apple certified store. There are some of those that are out there in the nation. We're not. So we don't lose customers overall for that. I think we've built a good reputation, Eric, over the last 9 years that we've been in business, that people know who we are, that we are local, that we are a small business, that we employ local, and we do a good job. And like Sabrina even said further, is that sometimes we know better on a fix than an Apple employee up in Chicago. They've not been in these phones as many times as we have. We've done thousands and thousands of repairs.
To go beyond Apple, there's certainly the behemoth in this conversation. Are there others that have posed problems too that are perhaps, in your view, scaring customers away from taking it to businesses like Terry's?
I would defer to Terry most for the consumer electronics, but there are definitely some other large companies outside of the consumer stuff that have been extremely problematic. And the two main buckets that falls into are really for farming, which is obviously a big thing here in Illinois. John Deere makes it really hard to repair their tractors, which leads to a lot of delays for small farmers. And then the other one that we saw a lot over the summer and through the pandemic really was that a lot of medical equipment manufacturers also use the same tactics and make it really difficult for hospitals to repair essential equipment. And one of the issues that came up was ventilators this summer during the pandemic. We talked to a lot of hospitals across the country with our national team that had in-house technicians who were capable of repairing that equipment, but it was software locked or they didn't have access to the diagnostic tools that they needed to fix it. And so these ventilators just sat unused in hospitals for weeks waiting for a manufacturer to come out to repair it.
That's Sabrina Clevenger with the Illinois Public Interest Research Group and electronics repair store owner Terry Ballantini with Eric Stock.
This is Sound Ideas on WGLT, and this is the final push of our spring fun drive. I'm Ryan Denham, here with Jennifer Armstrong, and we're asking for more friends, fans, and neighbors to come forward in the next 36 hours to pay for this public service, because we still have $18,000 left to reach our goal. Your contribution at WGLT.org in any amount will help power this fun drive across the finish line.
If you've never given or are wondering, well, why should I do that? Why should I contribute? Here are a few reasons. WGLT is a nonprofit. We're a community-powered station. Listener funding powers a local newsroom right down the street on the campus of Illinois State University. Your neighbors and friends cover the news in our community, not a nameless, faceless wire service from another city or state.
Your support pays for award-winning journalism. Associated Press Awards, Edward R. Murrow Awards, and much, much more decorate our newsroom. I know, I walk by it like every day on the way in. That level of journalism is worthy of your financial support. So please give at WGLT.org so it can continue.
Every day, the WGLT newsroom brings you the stories that help you understand the day's news. maybe you turn to WGLT for vaccination information or the latest from your elected officials.
A local newsroom matters. Newspapers are shrinking. We don't have TV stations covering Bloomington Normal like we did in the past. So WGLT and Sound Ideas bring you in-depth stories about health, community events, and newsmakers that you won't hear anywhere else. When you donate at WGLT.org, your contribution powers Sound Ideas, the Leadoff podcast, and that all-important local newsroom of award-winning journalists.
If you value local stories you hear and read from WGLT, you need to make sure it continues. Now is the time to step up with your individual financial support at WGLT.org and pay for the news and programming that powers your day. Give this fund drive a boost and help us raise $18,000 in the final hours with your donation at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. The town of Normal will add bicycle trail, do $2 million worth of road repairs this summer, and dig a new well. Those were among the choices town council members approved. Joining us to talk about those and other issues is Mayor Chris Koos of Normal. Some residents and one conservative town council member consider the issue of the trail extension one of parks versus roads. Mayor Koos says he resists that either-or framing.
I think we have to spend money on roads, and I think we spend money on trail infrastructure. And probably the impetus that made us move forward on this is the fact that we got a $150,000 grant from the state of Illinois to accomplish this. And the trail system connecting to Route 66 is a it's a regional amenity and a tourism amenity, as well as providing a recreational and transportation lane for our citizens.
How long has it been in the town master bicycle pedestrian plan?
Well, the plan was just updated recently. I think it had more to do with the Route 66 plan that we developed with the state of Illinois and communities from Chenoa to Atlanta. That was done probably 10 years ago.
How much bang for that buck does the town get in tourism and in local citizen use?
We have not done a trail extension in the community that wasn't well received by the community. It's a piece of transportation and recreation infrastructure in our community, and people that live in neighborhoods that don't have trail and get trail are always thankful for it.
The town of Normal is also hiring a lobbyist, the firm of McGuire Woods, at $4,000 per month. What will they be doing for that money?
Hard to pinpoint exact things, but they'll be looking for grants and capital opportunities, capital expenditure opportunities through the state to support our projects in the community. And that could be, as we just talked about, it could be trail extension, it could be road work improvements, it could be dollars from the state for underpass funding. Although, we're pretty far along on that, working with the state. So it's looking for opportunities to represent us to the legislature.
Don't Town of Normal staff already do the grant research and prospecting work?
They do identify it. We do get the information, but having someone on the ground and to carry our case to the legislature has helped. I mean, we've done it at the federal level and brought over $50 million of our tax dollars back to our community. And so we're looking to do something similar with the state. And most municipalities our size have lobbyists that work with the state legislature.
How well have past state lobbyists done for the town?
They have helped. We've only used one for, I think, two periods of about a year each, and there was a lapse in between. But they've helped us identify the right people to talk to, and taking our talking points to key legislature committees and that.
The town council has also approved digging a new well in Anderson Park and capping off two old ones that will no longer be in use because they silted up and they're no longer as productive as they were. The capacity for the wells, the new well, is higher than the existing performance of the two wells. How much difference will that make to Town of Normal residents?
Well, we think it will be higher. There's testing that gets done once the well is drilled to kind of predict what its output will be. We had two proposals in terms of pumping systems, one smaller than the other, and that's just based on what they find once they drill the well in terms of predictable flows.
Is the town still well situated, pardon the pun, for its future water needs?
We have very good capacity for delivering water to our residents. You know, if someone were to build, say, an ethanol plant or something like that, which demands huge amounts of water, then we might have to reevaluate and drill additional wells, but we don't see anything like that on the horizon.
In the $2 million in street resurfacing for the summer that the council has approved, are asphalt overlays of West Rab Road, Bradford Lane, Gregory Street, Bowl Street, Northville Avenue, and Normal Avenue. With the exception of Rab and perhaps part of Gregory, those are not particularly high traffic areas. Why those?
Because they deteriorated to the point that if we don't do a resurface on them, the subgrade could deteriorate further and the cost would rise exponentially. So they're just due to be resurfaced. We use a rating system, and we're changing that rating system on roads to be more compatible with what City of Bloomington and the County of McLean do. And it's a yearly evaluation of our road system in terms of which roads are going to need attention first. It just puts us on a more level playing field with our peer communities.
So what makes it better, or is the goal to be consistent?
You know, I don't know if it is better. It's a newer system, and I guess implementation and results of that system will tell that story. You know, our city engineer came from the city of Bloomington, so it's a system he's more familiar with and believes in. But at the end of the day, I think the important takeaway is that we're rating our road system every year to evaluate where the most need is.
Chris Goose is the mayor of Normal. The mayors of both Bloomington and Normal join us the day after most council meetings. Next week, Bloomington's mayor. This is the WGLT Spring Fund Drive, and it's not too late for you to contribute to the programming that you listen to every week and every year. You can go to WGLT.org and make a contribution. Curtis Henry Sr. has been dealing with pipes and poop for 57 years. The Bloomington Normal Plumbers Union is celebrating its longest-standing member. Over that time, Henry has seen the trade and the community evolve. Dana Vollmer reports.
Plumbing was in the family for Henry. His uncle, Lewis Garrison, was the first black plumber in Bloomington. Henry calls him Old Man Garrison. He was well known around town and helped bring many other black men into the profession. Henry was born and raised in Louisiana, but his uncle thought he'd lead a better life here.
They wanted to bring me up here for me to go to school. See, because I was one of them bad boys. Didn't want to go to school. I didn't want to do this. And he tried to get me to come to Bloomington. And I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't listen. So one day I got upset with my dad, my mom, and I jumped in my car and I started driving around. And then finally I wind up in Illinois.
This was in the 1940s. Henry was just a teenager. Things weren't easy in Bloomington Normal either. The first time Henry tried to help out with a job, he filled in a hole in someone's yard after his uncle's crew finished a job.
When the man come back that Monday morning, he said, "Who living this grandma up over here?" Old Man Garrison said, "Well, my nephew done that." He said, "Man," he said, "if they'd have caught him on that back hole," he said, "they'd have locked his ass up in jail." That's exactly what he said, because, see, black people wasn't allowed on these machines around here.
The next time around, Henry did it all by hand. He dug out a 6-foot by 5-foot hole with nothing but a shovel in under 4 hours, much to the surprise of his uncle.
He got out that truck, and he come and he looked, and I had all under the pipe, clean up everything, the whole thing done. He went and got two of the plumbers out of his shop and brought them there to see what I'd done, because he said we would hire people and it would take a day and a half to do what I'd done in 4 hours. So that's when he started saying he's going to make a plumber out of me.
Henry learned plumbing the same way many others did, in his uncle's basement on Empire Street. Soon enough, he was working on some of the biggest projects in the community.
My first biggest job that I had in Bloomington, Illinois was at State Farm. I put the first sewer into that building. on the west side of State Farm, that was nothing but a pond, and people used to fish and hunt out in that pond. So that's where the sewer was, in that pond.
Henry also did work on Bloomington High School and newly constructed buildings on the campus of Illinois State University. Henry says black men weren't always welcome on job sites.
When I started my job, it was hard because you was only allowed to do some jobs, and some jobs you couldn't go on. That's the way it was. But we, like we said, just do what you can do, and if they don't allow you on that, they don't want you to do that, then that was fine.
That changed over nearly six decades in the industry. Henry says homeowners were usually respectful if you follow one simple rule.
I go in the house and I take my shoes off at the door, got the plumbing work done, and then walk right on out there.
Henry says not all the changes are for the better. He says the quality of construction has degraded over the years, and plumbing is no exception.
I'm going to be honest with you. I would not put no plastic pipe in nobody's house in this world. And I wouldn't run that plastic pipe in nobody else for drinking water. That's not healthy. I don't go out there and preach that because they'll run me out of Bloomington, so I kind of keep my mouth shut.
The next generation of plumbers still rely on Henry as a source of wisdom and mentorship. Henry says he gets calls wanting advice on plumbing dilemmas, and he says he can solve them without even seeing the job.
Plumbing work is not hard. You just got to understand. Understand what to do and what not to do. And to me, it's easy.
Henry hasn't worked in 3 years. His wife got sick and needed a full-time caregiver. She passed away in November, and then his daughter died of cancer in February. It's been a hard year. And to top it all off, Henry hurt his back and isn't able to move very well. At age 87, most people would be happy to just kick back and relax. But Henry's ready to get back to the trade. He says he misses it a lot.
My back get better. I just may come out and try to do 50 more years plumbing.
When he's back on his feet, Curtis Henry says his first call will be down to the Union Hall. I'm Dana Vollmer.
Thanks for listening to Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker, and we are in the spring fund drive. We're making good progress, but we're not yet across the finish line. We still need more people to come forward and power this public media service with your financial support. Chip in at WGLT.org. During Fund Drive, we have to raise enough money to pay for all of the NPR and WGLT programs and news you know and love. A contribution in any amount at WGLT.org helps us get closer to the goal. NPR and WGLT are your go-to sources for credible and reliable facts, so please support them with a contribution now at WGLT.org, and thanks.